So I'm going to just jump right in. In the foreword of the Giving State report, it poses a question. What if the $3.5 billion given in the state of Utah on an annual basis had double the impact? And that's what this report is really about, making every dollar that's donated count and achieve outcomes for our community. So at the Community Foundation, our focus is Greater Park City. But as much as we like to think so, Park City doesn't operate in a bubble, I know. We're here in this great state and thought it would be excellent to bring both statewide and national experts to talk about where philanthropy is and where it's going. Our role, as Jack has pointed out, is to identify gaps and to really harness resources to where they have the most impact in the most critical issues. And that's what we're going to talk about today, is how you as donors can do that and then how we as foundations can help facilitate that. So the first thing I'm going to do is introduce our great panelists. And let's start all the way at the end with Tom Raffa. Tom is the CEO of Raffa Companies. He's a board member of ours and has spent his career catalyzing positive systemic change by linking corporations, people of wealth, and nonprofit organizations. So Tom, in addition to sharing some of your background, will you just tell us what you think is the most exciting development in philanthropy right now?
I think there's so many things going on and the changes that are happening. We're spending a lot of time on social impact, and so that's been social impact investing. There's a couple of ways to look at it real briefly is that in some ways it's a diversification of how to bring revenue in. So when we're talking about the tax law changes and the possibility of lower-end donors that are used to giving $100, $500 and things not being able to itemize anymore or using the standard deduction, how much money goes away, those people are looking more at some nonprofits have to be a little bit more creative. The other thing that I always say when I get people involved in social impact investing to the nonprofit community is it's a gateway drug to true philanthropy. And so there's a way to get people more involved in the philanthropic because philanthropy is sort of contagious as people start it. So that's one thing. The other thing is my friend Darren, who is the head of Ford Foundation now. For years, we used to spend time in very large foundations having those foundations think about their investments, and we'd say, here you are doing all this good work in low-income housing starts, for instance, if you're Ford, yet you're invested in tobacco and in apartheid in South Africa. And how do we change that? And so we changed their portfolios around. Now what we're getting them to do is look at their portfolios, their billions of dollars that are set up as assets that feed the dollars that are going out to organizations, and think about investing in what their mission is with the hard dollars that they have. So Darren set up a fund recently, and I'm very proud of him, that was $1 billion over 10 years that Ford will invest in low-income housing starts with the corpus of their dollars. So program-related investments, mission-related investments, and social impact investing are things that you're going to see on the horizon. And if you're involved in a nonprofit, like most of my clients are, we're trying to shift that focus so that they can start to think about new revenue sources as others may dry up.
Thanks, Tom. So next on our panel, we have Lindsay Knuven. She's head of social impact at Pluralsight, former chief impact officer at Cotopaxi, and also has held positions at Salesforce.org and my favorite, Silicon Valley Community Foundation. So Lindsay, we talked about this earlier. What does that mean, that title, head of social impact or chief impact officer? Share with us.
Sure. So it's actually funny. There's this intersection of sectors happening right now that's accelerating really quickly, and the corporate philanthropy space has evolved so rapidly over the last few decades. So there's been this need that's starting to surface for a dedicated person to really run those efforts. It's starting to transition really from corporate social responsibility and traditional, more give-back focused methods to much more strategic, integrated philanthropy with much more of a business model tied to that. So I'm responsible for all aspects of our corporate philanthropy at Pluralsight and at Cotopaxi as well. I was leading that work. This includes things like supply chain, ensuring that our supply chain is in line with our values, and that we're using that to drive you know, value for the business as well. It includes all of our investments socially, so building a strategy there, leveraging our product for good, determining how our technology, our product, our human capital, all of these things can be built into a system that achieves impact against our goals and aligning those social goals against more traditional business value. So I'm really responsible for building that and also doing it in a way that is sustainable for the company. It's not drawing from resources and sort of draining down on a corpus that has been gifted to sort of a foundation. I'm responsible for creating a social enterprise and really generating revenue through the deeply discounted sale of our product to the nonprofit space that will fuel our investment in social impact. So it's building a business within a business, integrating that, and then, you know, building all of the strategy tied to our giving that complements our company's traditional business values.
Thank you. And Jacob Allen. Jacob is Managing Director of Cicero Social Impact. And there and elsewhere has worked with clients such as Prudential, the George W. Bush Institute, the Clinton Foundation, United Way, Goldman Sachs, Alzheimer's Association. So what inspired you to write the Giving State Report?
Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here with you. Thanks, Katie. To be honest, frustration. And the frustration was with this interesting paradigm or dichotomy that I think is acutely real here in Utah, but it exists elsewhere. And it's that there is so much good activity, good effort, and good intention. Lots of donations, lots of people that care about their communities, lots of good nonprofit organizations, lots of funding. And yet, on the other side of that coin, it's not clear where all that good activity is going and what it's accomplishing. And so there's not as much measurement of results that, as Jack talked about earlier, there's not as much understanding of what the core issues are that drive social challenges. There's not as much evidence about how we're going to change over time. And rather, it's a focus on, oftentimes, nonprofits and funders focus on how much money they've been giving or how many people they've been serving. And imagine those of you who have run a business, if you reported to your shareholders every year, well, we've spent $X.2 million this year. We're on a tear, right? That's essentially what nonprofits are saying or funders are saying when we say we've donated X amount of money this year. Isn't that great? And it is, but only as it is a means to an end, right? Only as it accomplishes the goals that those individuals, those funders, have set out to do. And so in the Giving State Report, we wanted to understand what was happening in the space throughout Utah and on all sides of these issues, of funders and nonprofits and others in the space, to say, what are you doing? What do you understand? Why are you doing it? And where might there be opportunities for elevating the impact of this wonderful set of activities that are going on?
Great. So I've prepared two questions for the panel, and then I'll turn it back to you all to ask some questions. And my first question begins with a quote from the report, which is, 21st century philanthropy values transparency, equity, and respect. It loves visionary thinking and big bets. And I'd love to hear examples of visionary thinking and big bets in practice. And whoever wants to take it first.
I can start. I'm actually not so sure that I agree with the quote. I think one of the things that holds our sector back, the nonprofit sector, is our inability to take risk. If you think about your for-profit businesses, the things that are available to you, there's a statistic that I'm probably going to get wrong, but that says that, you know, since 1970, only 40 nonprofits have grown to be over $40 million, whereas companies have soared into the thousands that have grown that much. And if you think about why that's the case, part of it is their inability to take risk, part of it is their access to capital, part of it is we underpay our workforce. So I think while people sometimes ask for that, the reason why maybe other investments in other methodologies of where they're looking for some kind of return, whether that's monetary or factually some qualitative methodology, more risk can be taken. But for right now, I still have clients that if they make a mistake, if the executive director bills something that doesn't work, A lot of times there's a lot more repercussions of there than there is in my business. My business, I think of myself as a mad scientist that continually makes experiments. They blow up in my face. They singe my eyebrows. They don't blow my head off, and I start over again. And I work on that until I get it right. I wish the sector had more of that. And I think it's going to take people like us that are investing in it to say it's okay to do that. Methodologies now are a foundation gives you a couple of $1 million, says come back in 3 years. You go back to those people in 3 years and say it worked or it didn't work, or I started the housing starts you wanted to me and nobody moved in. By that time, it's already too late. The metrics need to be set up and the theories need to be tried throughout the process, and investors are typically more like that. So when I see people that I'm encouraging to really participate, the participation is not just an observation. It's also not giving recommendations, because to work in an area that you don't know is probably not the best thing for you. But if you are looking to solve a homelessness problem, we have to stop thinking about it being a service business of feeding homeless people and curing the problem. And that takes risk and experimentation, and I still don't think there's enough of it in our sector.
So when I think of big bets, and I agree there's not enough of them, and because they're risky and other kinds of things, but when I think of big bets, they're characterized by a few quick attributes. One is there's a concentration on a specific issue, right, and with a specific audience or target population. So you're not spreading a lot of money all over the place on lots of different things, but you're focusing on something that you think you can solve. Secondly, is it's filling a gap, right? So but to do that, you have to identify where the gaps are. And three, it usually involves some innovative activities or work. And I've been lucky to be involved in a couple of these, and these will sound really big. Well, they are big. But I hope that you'll be able to see how this might apply to your own activities and thinking. So several years ago, Goldman Sachs, as everybody knows Goldman Sachs, lots of money at its disposal, lots of influence at its disposal, said we do want to do something big. And there's certainly some PR and corporate social responsibilities factors that played into that. But it was also because they wanted to make a big difference in the world. And so they looked at the space of the developing world and said, where is there a need? And they saw they're interested in growing economies and helping people get jobs and grow local livelihoods throughout the developing world. And in doing a pretty comprehensive scan of that whole space, they said, well, there's a lot of activity at the very micro level. So you've heard of microfinance and microenterprise development and those kinds of things. Well, there's a lot of activity going on there, and there's the ability, the capacity, and investments that happen at large companies, even if you're in a very developing context. So there's ability to get capital into those kinds of companies. But there's a missing middle in between of small and medium-sized enterprises, and it's particularly acute for women-owned enterprises. And so they said, after that fair amount of research, there's a gap, and it's something we can fill. And they said, we're going to spend $100 million over 5 years, lots of money, more than I have in my bank account, a lot more. But they said, we're going to stick with it for at least a long period of time, because we know this is going to take a while, one. Two, they said, we're going to convene over the years, they ended up convening 80 different partners, universities, nonprofit organizations, companies, and others that were their clients, that were their partners on other activities, because they knew they could leverage those relationships and assets to do more than what they would be able to do with just $100 million, right? And then they developed a program that was replicated throughout 20 different countries in the world. And over the years, they then did a lot of work to demonstrate the results of that, showing that women who went through this program, on average, increased their revenues 2x or more over the next 18 months, and added 5 or 7 jobs, new jobs, in their local communities. Which again, as you add all that up, over 10,000 women and then subsequently hundreds of thousands of people, makes a big difference. Anyway, it's a fascinating program. They replicated it again in the United States. But there were, again, the characteristics of sticking to it for a while, filling a gap, measuring for results, and concentrating efforts, I think are characteristic of successful big bets.
Great. So I agree with Tom that, you know, there's there's a lack of this behavior, and part of it is because you have human risk. You know, if you place a big bet and you're wrong, lives are impacted. So there is a different kind of driver at play often. But you also have funders who aren't funding towards risk. So, you know, there are a lot of complexities operating in the nonprofit space that prevent really innovative solutions. One example I'll give on the corporate side, just to sort of balance this, is, you know, Salesforce years ago made a really big bet to devote 1% of time, product, profit, and equity to its social impact work. And this was done when shareholders were really skeptical. That model was unfamiliar. It had not been done before. And it proved to catapult the company in a totally different direction. It meant that, you know, through the contribution of time, every employee had 7 paid days time off to volunteer. This created a culture of giving that really changed the way Salesforce operated. It turned it into something, you know, as part of the new hire orientation, there was a half-day volunteer event for every employee that came on board. And so the values were, like, really positioned front and center. It also meant that you had employees who were empowered as sort of individual philanthropists within their organization, and they could use their skills to really drive the product in ways that were more inclusive. So it was creating product that not just had, you know, economic value, but also that was building solutions for the social sector. And through that, they've cultivated a massive ecosystem of thousands and thousands of nonprofits globally. They now give tens of millions of dollars in grants annually through the contribution of that initial pre-IPO equity as well as annual profit. They, through the social enterprise they've created through the sale of product to nonprofits, have been able to generate millions of dollars that fuel that grant making. So they've really created a legacy. Years ago, they also created what was called Share the Model. It was sort of templatizing this approach and enabling other companies, no matter what size they were, to understand the levers that they have. It's not just cash that you can give. It's not just founders' equity. You have all these different levers within a business you can pull. And so they started to create resources tied to best practices for each of those. They've now turned that into Pledge 1%, which has scaled to over 3,000 companies globally. So it's a community of like-minded companies. And Mark Benioff, the founder, has also joined a movement called the B Team, which he sort of co-founded with Richard Branson, Muhammad Yunus, and a number of other luminaries. And they are positioning this as the future of business. You know, the future of business is integrated. The public sector alone cannot solve these problems. These problems right now they're complex, they're global in nature. We really need the private sector to engage in strategic ways. And so Salesforce took a risk and built that model, advocated for that model. It's front and center in everything they do at Dreamforce now. They have thousands of nonprofit attendees. So for them, it was never about, you know, this will ultimately lead conversion to paid customers. This will ultimately yield some sort of business benefit that we can monetize. It was really about, we believe, the whole nature of business is being transformed, and we can lead that movement. So I think they really put a stake in the ground in that, and now have demonstrated through some big failures and through some big successes that that can be intentional and a core part of your business model.
Thank you for all those comments. My next question is a bit of a switch, and it's about overhead. So the giving state says throughout the report how important unrestricted funding is to lead to impact. However, it quotes a statistic that 45% of the public think it's unacceptable to fund overhead. So can we just talk about overhead?
Yeah, it probably goes beyond that even to, like, unrestricted funding and things like that. But when I was on the radio yesterday, somebody had asked about it, and I said, you know, it's in my generation, there's so much of a focus on overhead with all of our clients and Charity Navigator and all the rest of it. It's like, you know, do I really want my legacy when I leave my company to be, hey, we kept overhead down in all the nonprofit sector, right? I mean, is that really what I want on my tombstone? And I would say absolutely not. It is all about the impact. So part of it is just to think about, again, as a giver, as a donor, what it is that you're really after. And the true function of impact exists because of overhead and because of reserves that are set up for companies. Nonprofits need them as bad as others do. A good example is I had a very wealthy client that wanted to give a couple $100,000 to cancer research, and I convinced him and her to give it to fundraising, and they were able to use the $300,000 to raise $7 million for cancer research. So, you know, there is some leveraging that can be done there too. So I think part of the whole issue around this converts itself if we focus on impact and not necessarily how these experts are going to that are the nonprofit community are going to get us there, and spend less time worrying about, you know, the overhead that it costs to get us there.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of unrestricted funding, because I think, you know, as you approach a nonprofit, you're really investing in their model and their leadership. So to unlock them and enable them to be nimble, to build for the future, to scale, to adapt, to change, you know, these are really important abilities that you can fund towards. And when you restrict grants, I think a lot of times the driver is that people want that attribution between their exact contribution and an impact metric. And some of that has been, I think, stimulated by the nonprofit messaging around, you know, for this dollar, you will achieve this unit of impact. You know, it costs us X amount to serve one person, 99% of our money goes towards programming. That has perpetuated this sense among donors that I want to go all in on programming, I want my money to go to the people who are beneficiaries, but really that prevents organizations from building in a sustainable way. And so, you know, I think some of the benefits to sustainable and unrestricted funding are, you can't just give it alone. You really have to develop a partnership mindset with the organizations that you're engaging. You have to be validating them. You know, to just give any organization unrestricted funding may not yield the outcomes you're expecting, but if you can validate them, really look at their leadership and their model and the way that they're measuring and evaluating impact and tracking that over time, are those the right indicators that they're looking at, and are they evaluating change in an effective way? You know, once you've assessed those things and they've aligned with your strategy, then you can fund in a way that is less restricted and really enabling freedom. We have, I think, seen more of a trend towards unrestricted funding in the last few years, but it's still limited. You see some higher net worth donors moving in that direction, and it's complicating for nonprofits, because they often have to report impact in very different ways. They have to tell a different story to engage donors who are willing to give unrestricted funds versus those who want to give highly programmatic funding or highly restricted funding. So one of the things I hope to see over time is that in addition to supporting fundraising or operations or research or those types of things, that we'll also fund towards effective monitoring and evaluation systems that enable organizations to really track and then report out to donors in a streamlined way, so they're not having to do individualized reporting for every donor based on that donor's desires and parameters. So I'm hoping that as funders who give in unrestricted grants, we're able to kind of shift that equation and empower nonprofits to really lead the conversation about how they're defining impact and how they're making progress towards that goal.
I'll just echo this. It's something I'm pretty passionate about as well. On one hand, I understand some of the motivations for focusing on limiting overhead allocations or restricting grants and funding to programmatic efforts. You want to avoid fraud and misuse of funds. You want to make sure that you're helping everyone who gives, for the most part, cares about the cause, and especially about the people that you're serving. And so you want to know that your dollars are going to people, right? You want to, and we've asked people in surveys and other things, you know, what do you care about? Well, I care about my next dollar serving somebody else. So I understand that motivation. But the challenge is, again, as you think about, say, a company, for example, your last flight, how often did you think about whether or not the shareholders or the management team was saying, we've got to limit our overhead to 3%, And so that means we're going to cut down on our quality assurance and our safety issues. We're going to cut down on our marketing. And we're going to cut down on the salaries that we pay senior level people. I mean, that's no company, no shareholder, no equity, you know, owner would ever think in that way. Would they want to cut down on costs? Sure. But to what end? Again, it's to the intention, the what you're trying to accomplish. And so unrestricted funding does not mean unintentional funding. And I think that's the switch we need to make, and as Tom and Lindsay are talking about, is what are we trying to get with our funding, and not confuse inputs or activities, what we're spending it on, with the outcomes we're going to get from that. And so my encouragement, again, is not to ask what's your overhead percentage and use that as benchmark of good organizations, but rather say, what is success? And do you have evidence of that success? And if I give you this money, what will you put it for toward? And how will that increase your success? How will that increase the numbers of people you can serve? And especially, more importantly, the quality or of the impact that you're achieving with those people that you're serving. And that will open up a very different conversation with the people you're trying to give to and the organizations you'll give to. They'll first be surprised, in many cases, the nonprofit leaders will be surprised that you're asking those questions. But once you get past that surprise, they'll say, wow, we could really use funding for X, Y, and Z, because nobody else will let us pay for that. And if you push them on that and say, well, how is that going to help you? They'll hopefully be able to say, well, measurement and evaluation will help us know whether what we're doing is working and improve over time. And a little bit more money for fundraising, if we do it in a smart way, will help us multiply the value of your donation so that we can help even more people. Or a little bit higher salary for some really top-notch talent, whether that's a caseworker or whether that's a teacher or whatever the case may be, will increase the quality of the impact we can achieve by X. And that actually can be a litmus test for you. If they can't answer those questions, then that's a sign that maybe they're not ready for a really solid, high-quality, unrestricted investment. But if they can answer those questions, it means they're thinking hard about what is going on that drives value and impact in their work.
Excellent. So I'd love to turn it to you and take some questions, and I'll wander around the mic.
Hi, I'm Sally Wilson, and I have sort of a couple of questions follow up on that. And so one question is, do you have a sense of, within the state of giving in Utah, what are people, majority of people, just giving, and is it staying local? And, you know, if it's not, are there any strategies that can begin to change that paradigm of keeping it local and focusing it, you know, in a local community impact?
Go ahead. Jacob. Yeah,
yes. So I just have with me the executive summary, and I'm forgetting the numbers, but there is a chart in the full report that talks about how much of giving from Utah goes to local communities versus the entire state versus national and versus global. The vast majority is going local, both to communities and statewide. And I think, you know, I don't have an opinion necessarily on whether that's good or bad. I think it's entirely appropriate for the individual funders to say, this is what I care about and this is what I'm going to focus on, whether it's the location and the population that I'm serving or the issue that I care about.
And do you think that's happening? I guess that's one of the questions.
Here's what I
think.
Here's
a
yeah, so there's also some discussion about religious giving in there as well. And I think there is a significant amount of giving that is associated with religious giving in the state, not surprisingly. And that's been known for a while. However, there's also a lot of giving by religious givers to nonprofit organizations. And secondly, the religious giving also comes back into the system in many different ways, right? So it might be, in fact, a substitute for what in other places would require nonprofit organizations, right? And quantifying the net effect of that is impossible right now, frankly, and we tried to get into that, but it's a little difficult. The last thing I'll say, and Lindsay jump in, is what I think is lacking is awareness and intentionality about why I'm giving to what I'm giving and what I'm getting out of that. What is happening as a result of that? And so, you know, it's hard to quantify that as well, but I would say the vast majority, probably 90 plus percent of dollars given by individuals in the state is relatively uninformed and unintentional. And that's not too dissimilar from other places. So it's not that Utah is significantly, you know, backwards in that sense. But that's also the reason why we posed the question at the beginning, that we think that without any more dollars going into the system, impact could easily double.
So how do you change that?
Yeah.
So one of the things that's complicated is right now there's a ton of unrestricted giving happening, but that is not necessarily the type of unrestricted giving we're talking about wanting to see more of. There's a lot of giving, 90-something percent of that as well, is not tied to grant reports or any sort of accountability measures. So you have donors giving pretty big investments, whether corporate or individual, that are very much trust-based and highly relational. So it's perpetuating a lack of accountability among nonprofits for outcomes measurement. There's a lot of output measurement, but not a ton of outcome measurement. So imagine the road home, you give a grant, instead of organizations tracking, we fed X number of people tonight, we want to see outcomes that are tied to solving that root issue. So transition out of homelessness, we want to see things like that being measured and tracked. Right now, that there's very little of that at scale. You also have, you know, a nonprofit community that is fairly unsophisticated. You have a lot of organizations that have very low annual budgets, which doesn't necessarily always track to an indicator of sophistication, but they're very small, hyper-local organizations. You have the highest per capita in the country number of nonprofits being created annually. So I think we have something like 50 nonprofits every 2 weeks, right? Being created.
Yeah.
So this DIY mentality is breeding a massive influx into the nonprofit space of young and small organizations. So donors are saturated with requests. And you have the choice to sort of invest in relationships and help seed fund, essentially, a small organization that is really passionate about something versus, you know, trying to find an organization within that sea of organizations that really has a proven model. So evidence-based philanthropy is not very widely proven to be happening here yet. I do think we're going to see more and more global giving as, you know, you have companies that have operations globally, so they have a much bigger footprint. You also have donors who may have a second residence here, so they're going to be giving here and elsewhere. So donor trends are a little bit fragmented, but I think we have a real opportunity to help shape some of the donor behavior that will drive more accountability within the nonprofit space.
Yeah, that's really where it is I think it's on the donor side, because we, you know, again, if you look at all of the nonprofits that are starting up, and it is given relationship giving, right, there's less collaboration because everybody's competing for those dollars. So, you know, if I get to my nonprofits that say, well, all of you folks are in homelessness, these are the grantors, they don't necessarily know that from the other people that may be working in a soup kitchen, because they don't want you to know all of the funders that they have, right? So it's not this public information. It's also not on the 990, so you can't find out that information. It's not that's the one thing about the 990 that's not public. So there becomes this competitive nature, and I think what we've created, like I created a nonprofit called Companies for Causes, where all of the CEOs get together and try to work on social problems. Again, I think capitalism is probably one of the better ways to solve some of these things, because we do have access to marketing and things that nonprofits don't. But the truth is that we can get folks to collaborate. We can look at three programs in a high school that DC Cap, College Summit, College Bound, that are all about getting these kids out of the local high schools into colleges, and they all function differently, but they all compete against each other. And I can place them, because as a donor, I can say this is what I want you to achieve within this population of the school, and then DC Cap will take it over for the rest of the way, and they'll cooperate because I'm the one that's investing, and that's smart philanthropy. And it's not really happening all that much yet. And so I could speak on a national level where I think most people are giving based on, you know, on just, it's not outcome-driven at all, and they're not expecting those kinds. So a good example was, if you get back to homelessness, my friend Robert Ebert, that started the DC Kitchen, is now in L.A. He came to me one day and said, I said, how's it going? He said, oh, I'm feeding more homeless people than ever. I said, does that mean there's more, or you've been able to reach more? And he said, well, I think there's more. And I said, well, when you started, was that your goal? And he said, of course not. My goal was to solve homelessness. It's like, well, then we're not doing it. Breast cancer's on the rise. All these things that we have these efforts for that we've put millions of dollars into, they're not being solved. And so there was this, the quote in there, which is the standard thing about the starfish, right? It's, you really have to, for me, I always say, there's babies floating downstream. We're rushing to pull them out. Somebody's got to go upstream and figure out who's throwing the babies in and how to stop that from happening. And we do far less of that. So that's actually what my company does, is we spend a lot of time looking at where the problems and fixing systemically, catalyzing change, like systemically. And that takes a sophisticated donor. And, you know, so foundations are no better at it, and they do this for a living. You know, they give out tens of millions of dollars a year for a living, and they don't do it very well. So it's an educational process. But this report was a really good start, I think. Very well done.
A few more questions?
Hi, Tom, one of the things you just said really resonated with me. Frankly, everything everybody said has resonated. I thank you all for the really great questions, Katie, and interesting answers. I talked to an executive director of a charity similar to Park City Community Foundation. It's an umbrella. They picked and chose charities they tried to develop. And he was talking about a charity that took kids who were not in employment, education, or training, and they were bragging to him about how successful they were. They'd gotten 80% of the people in the program into jobs. And that was their metric. That was a pretty solid metric, and you could audit it. This executive director did more. He said, well, is that really what I want? Do I want someone to get a job, or do I want someone to get a job and keep it? So he did his own research and found out that this program was very good at calling Price Waterhouse or this employer or that employer and getting some kid into the mailroom, but the kids weren't there 12 months later. And so, and to your point about inputs and outputs. You know, with commercial businesses, inputs are money, outputs are money. This is so much harder, Katie, for you and the people in the sector. Your inputs, money, or outputs, something different. So, Katie, my question maybe is for you or the directors of the Park City Community Foundation. Do you guys have the expertise or the resources you need to not only look at the charities, but to push them on their metrics and to think of your own metrics? And if I could ask a second part of the question, have you ever decided to stop funding somebody because they didn't meet the standards you had set?
Are you channeling Jack? Because that's his favorite question. Yes, I mean, I'm going to answer the second question first and carefully walk by the speaker so I don't crush your ears. So yes, one of the key things that we do is site visits on an annual basis of our community fund grantees. So we give a lot of grants to our donor advised funds, and then we have some unrestricted funding where we make the grant decisions. And on an annual basis, we visit all of them. And it's an hour long, Sid leads them with our grants committee team, and we invite you all to participate. That calendar is forthcoming, and we'll make sure you have it. And it's this incredible opportunity to really do a deep dive check-in with the organizations. Now, we spend all year with the nonprofits, so this isn't the only time we're having conversations. There's a lot of stop by here, hey, pick my brain about this. But this is our annual check-in, and it's amazing what you learn about, are they strategic? Are they setting priorities that are 1 year and 3 years out? And then are they meeting them and moving on? And so often our granting ends when there's no progress. And it's the same obstacle year after year. And you think, gosh, in this time, you haven't moved. And this other organization has rebuilt its infrastructure, identified a new programming need, funded it, and it's in action. I mean, and you just see the difference. So I was going to say this earlier, but it's a good window for it. I encourage you all to visit the nonprofits you care about in these site visits, because you just can't, as wonderful as KPCW is for all of us, and it truly is, you know, that you can't get your whole story out in that. And so this really provides an opportunity for the leadership of that organization to share their strengths, weaknesses, what's going well, what not, and you get an idea of that if we had this, we could move forward this way. Your first question about, do we have that expertise to push the nonprofits on the measurement and evaluation? And I'll be honest, I sit here listening to this and I get a little nervous, like, oh, are we as evidence-based as we should? It's hard, and I think it's a work in progress. For something like the Solomon Fund, you know, that's a little over a year in. I think that's a good example of a person with a vision. Let's integrate our sports, let's get kids playing together. Took a big bet on us, and we're working out the kinks. I mean, we knew what the barriers would be. We didn't know where our resources would have the most impact. So, and Diego, feel free to step in, and Sarah back here, but what we're learning is these teams want these kids really badly. They just don't know how to get them. So by providing translation, outreach to families, we thought we would be spending all of our money on scholarships, and that's just not the case. Our money is coming in more on the coordination, translation, cultural outreach. And so we have a bit, you know, we have an outcome we want, parity with the school district, 21% participation. That's sort of what we're setting all of our focus against. But how we measure that right now is like team by team, and so it's messy. It's messy. And so we're working on it, I guess.
Well, you and I are
Yeah.
This is a hot spot issue for us.
Yeah.
So M&E is really difficult because especially measurement and evaluation. So as a community foundation, you're essentially a holder of hundreds of mini foundations. And each of those may have their own strategies, their own grant-making priorities, their own their funding horizon. Everything is different. You also have your own, if you have unrestricted grants or an endowment, you have your own grant-making strategy. So for example, at Silicon Valley Community Foundation where I worked, you know, we had $8.2 billion in assets under management, massive community foundation, huge grant-making capacity. Drop the B.
We're not there yet.
So, but the crazy thing is, you know, we only had five grant focus areas for that, and we were expert in how to measure progress against each of those. But at the same time, we have hundreds of donor-advised priorities, and so you have to become, you know, for Katie and team, part of it is you're developing your own system and your own framework for measuring progress against your strategic focus areas, you know, the Solomon Fund, others. But you also become a resource to help donors build that for themselves, fund towards it, identify challenges in that when they have a grant that's not demonstrating the type of progress that they want to see. So I think that's where the community foundations have huge value, is really helping to build that strategic capacity among the donors and providing that sounding board for, if you're not seeing the outputs and the outcomes that you want to see, how can you structure your funding differently? How can you formulate funding requirements or unlock funding at certain milestones to ensure progress? You know, there are lots of different mechanisms you have available that they can help you with, and I think that's, though they may not be cause specific and understand which indicators you should be tracking against all of those causes, they can help you with the process.
Can I, really quickly, all of that is real and true and should be paid attention to and is complex, right? And so I guess my encouragement would be to think about this. Somebody told me this yesterday and I think it's brilliant. Think about, just as you know, the power of compounding interest, think of the power of compounding intentionality. And measurement, and say, you know, you're not, as an individual or as a community foundation, going to know it all or understand it all right now, but start, right? And the sooner you start asking good questions and thinking in intentional ways about outcomes, the faster you'll get up that curve and learn. And that is true for the nonprofits you're working with and a variety of funders. These are complex issues. Nobody has a formula that says, here's how you solve homelessness, right? There are proven models, and there's growing evidence about what does and doesn't work, but it's not entirely clear, and it's really messy, right? And that's going to continue to be true on any of these issues. And so, not to put a plug in for the report, but in there are a few key questions and things that funders can do and ask themselves, even if you don't know how to measure it all yet, and even if you don't know about that particular issue area yet. There are some simple things that you or the community foundation or anybody can ask, like, wait, what are you ultimately trying to do? No, tell me again, what are you ultimately trying to do? Is it really about the number of people we're serving or feeding or whatever, or is it about the change in the life or the change in the community that we're trying to achieve? Okay, interesting. Why do you believe that what you're doing is going to achieve that? Do you have evidence? Do you have a really good set of examples? Do you have experience? Do you have data? Those simple questions of what are you trying to do? Why do you believe it's going to work? And how will you know? Those questions are, again, pretty basic, but you'll continue to learn over time, and the organizations you work with, whether community foundations or nonprofit organizations, will likewise continue to learn, and that's a process that will compound over time.
Yeah, I also think getting there is certainly messy. I agree with that. I disagree that metrics are so hard to determine. I think if you're thinking big and you're saying to what end on these things, I mean, again, yours is a perfect example. I go through this with the school that we're working in Ward 6 in DC. There's a 48% dropout rate when they reopen this high school, okay? So if our goal is that every kid graduates with the understanding that really what we're after is no kid's going to end up on the street. So if they join the military, vocational, we count that as a win. How do we change that? Getting there is really, really difficult. But pushing it all the way to the end that these children will graduate high school at a minimum, you know, the college is a whole different issue and everything, to me is an unbelievable goal that we can establish. Now, how we get there and how we continue to develop metrics for that, to measure that in terms of success, I think sometimes we just miss things. We know, for instance, that if you are at reading level in the third grade, you have a better chance to graduate than if you're not. Okay, so why not use that statistic? I don't have to wait 15 years to figure that out. I got to go back up that river, and all of a sudden my project at Eastern High School is now called All Roads Lead to Eastern, and we're basically moving it all the way back to the preschool level, where I've got GW students reading to kids before they go into the first grade. Okay, because it's such a fundamental need, and I know if I fix that, when I'm not around, maybe 15, 25 years from now, these kids will graduate. So I think sometimes we all get hung up on this, oh, how hard is it to measure? And yeah, there's no funding for it and all the rest of the stuff. But starting out as an accountant where everything is quantifiable, even things that are qualitative, they can be measured. I think what happens is we don't ask to what end. And so you stop with something like, well, we got the kid a job. Well, that's not what the purpose was. The purpose was for this kid to work for the rest of his life and have a career and be interested in it. And then the testing becomes somewhat different. And so I think as donors, if we just continually say, you're doing this, but to what end? What's the reason Bino's doing what she's doing? Is it integration? To what end will integration help our community? And I think we start asking that question, the road there becomes a little bit clearer.
More and more, one thing I'm finding and one thing we look for as funders is who are the nonprofits who are coalition builders? Because these big indicators and measurements, no organization can meet them on their own. For instance, in our mental health and youth work, we're using this data called SHARP data. It's statewide data. It's released every 2 years. That's what we're going to measure our progress on like, how are our kids doing? But not one organization is going to own that result. And so when you're talking to nonprofits and making your donor decisions, you probably want to listen for, hey, we own this piece and it's important to this bigger thing that we're trying to accomplish with a whole group of folks that we meet with monthly, every month, every other month, whatever it is. Because it's in those coalitions that I think, to use Tom McCausland's word, the big C, the really big causes start to be addressed. So we're running late on time again because of those really nice extra runway. One last question, Steve Ginder.
I can project. Deb tells me to project.
All right. Yeah, those are great questions and a good segue. Yeah, So Steve asked to give a little background on the Community Foundation, how you can get involved, and then how do we make our granting decisions? So with the Community Foundation, you know, people are involved with us in all different ways. Most of the folks here are contributors on an annual unrestricted, the magic dollars, basis of $2,500 more on an annual basis. And if you're not and are interested, I'd love to talk to you about that, of course. And also we have our Women's Giving Fund, which was an effort to build an endowment that will forever support women and children here in Summit County. And I think is an excellent way to get people of all ages involved in philanthropy, because on an annual basis you get to vote on some grantees. And that's a good window in how we do our grant making. So we have grants committees that drive our decisions. We do site visits, we do financial analysis, and we of course lean on the expertise of our staff, primarily Ollie, but really we hire people who have on the ground relationships here, who are active and participants in our community, so that we know what's going on. So we go to council meetings, we read reports, you know, we do the data and research to know what the needs are, but we also have really close relationships with all the nonprofits. And so executive directors will call us up and say, hey, this isn't really in my purview, but like, what are you doing about XYZ, or who's working on? And so with that, we have this knowledge about where the gaps are and how they can be filled. And then with the constant relationship building and visiting with our nonprofits and check-ins, we have a pretty good sense of what programs are working and not. So we start with site visits, we go back to site visits. It's a lot of on-the-ground time with people, really and truly. So we are running low on time. I just want to thank our wonderful panel for spending the morning with us and bringing your expertise. I want to give them 30 seconds to help you think about next steps in your own giving and share any final thoughts. And then I'll see who wants to keep skiing, and then we'll conclude.
Great. Thank you all. Great questions, and great. This is a great group. I guess two quick things, and it's pretty simple. I said this before, be as intentional as you can be. You know, think about the things that made you successful in other areas of life, whether business or family or community or whatever, and think about applying those to your philanthropy. And that, again, involves asking, what am I really trying to achieve? What are my focus areas? What do I care about? And let's focus on those things, not just spread it all around whenever somebody asks. And secondly, how do I know when it's going to be, when it's going to work, and how will I know when it's working? So I think those are two basic things of focusing on outcomes, on results, on long-term change for individuals and communities, and that will transform your relationships with your nonprofit organizations that you're working with others that you're involved with in the community, and I think make it not only more gratifying on a personal level, but much more meaningful for the community.
Packed a lot into 30 seconds. You know, I would say find joy in your giving. It should be, it's a privilege to be able to give. And so at the root of it, we're talking a lot about strategy and all of these things, but you have to be really empowered to have that joy and that sort of purity in your giving. I would encourage you to read the Giving State Report, especially the executive summary, where it pulls out some of the top themes and figure out how you can contribute as a donor to help shape the future of philanthropy in Utah. And ask those questions, you know, really seek context and try to understand how you can connect their work or their actions or the activities to this big problem. Because ultimately, we want to all be putting ourselves out of business in this space. We want to solve the root challenge, and the more your funding and your collaboration and your questions can catalyze that work, the better.
I think communities cause community problems, communities fix them. There's no one solution to them. I think part of in our work with groups that, with folks that have lots of money, is they think the dollars will fix the problems very easily. There's a lot of smart people that work in the nonprofit sector that have done this their entire life, and they have, and they should be listened to, and collaboration should be started with those people. On the younger side, 67% of the people that work in my firm are under 32 years old. They're very purpose-driven. And so what we look for from them is they don't necessarily want to invest in any one person or any nonprofit. They want to invest in the solution that might be veterans, that might be homelessness, that might be health issues, workforce development. And in helping them to find the best and the brightest to do that with that are in the community, I think, again, that's really the collective impact that we want to have as a corporation, as we have our individual donors, as our philanthropists, our foundations, and the people that work for us. And I think with that, communities can fix community problems. It's all just a reallocation of our resources and the skill set that exists within among all of us. So keep to it.
So thank you all for joining us today. Thank you for your support. Special thanks, Bill Rock is here now. It couldn't have been a lovelier morning. His staff is always really excellent in showing us a nice time, and the views were great too. On your table, you'll see our giving guide, which is an orientation to Park City nonprofits, where Sarah Warbelow from the Board of Realtors is here, Tom Raffa, also key sponsor. Plenty of copies of the giving state, and Jacob has more if we need them. And I just want to encourage you to look to the Community Foundation as your advisor in all of these decisions. You know, if you're thinking about an issue or an organization, please do not hesitate to pick up the phone and give us a call. We love nothing more than talking about and connecting you to the really wonderful nonprofits and change makers here in Park City.